It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A Neenah resident recently received emails from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security calling for him to self-deport, saying, quote, "Do not attempt to remain in the United States. The federal government will find you," even though he is a citizen of the United States, born in Pennsylvania.
He reached out to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin's office, and the mistake was eventually corrected. But the question that remains is, who is being deported or under threat of deportation? Today, we look at the deportation drive and how it affects people in a wide variety of legal situations.
Sarah McKinnon is a UW-Madison professor in rhetoric, politics, and culture. She's co-chair of the university's human rights program, and her books include Gendered Asylum, Race and Violence in U.S. Law and Politics. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today. Sarah,
thanks for having me. Sorry.
Looking at this story WPR reported, Tom Franz and Neenah receiving these emails saying leave the United States, even though he's a citizen, not the only case like that in the country. What does that say to you about the scope of this drive for mass deportations over the last couple months?
Yeah, I mean, I see a number of people that received that message. Those with parole status reportedly received that message. And it was really alarming. And as you mentioned, with the Neenah resident, U.S. citizens also mistakenly received that message. I think this is an indication of just how many efforts are at work right now to really ramp up the deportation regime. And some of these efforts are things that we've seen before. And some are completely new tactics. And so there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of worry and concern. And there's a significant concern about individuals' due process and really having the chance to demonstrate that they have a legitimate reason to be in the United States, that they are in regular status, or that they are, in fact, U.S. citizens, as is the case with the story you reported.
I wanted to bring up the issue of due process. There have been arguments. Do people of different statuses, if ICE comes to them, do they have due process right to challenge deportation? A concern if U.S. citizens are accidentally or otherwise targeted by ICE as here illegally, and they, because of that targeting, don't receive due process, they would have no opportunity to explain, I am in fact a citizen. Is there a concern that without that assumption of due process for all these categories, people who clearly shouldn't be deported could still end up being removed from the country?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a concern. There are instances of people who have been deported who shouldn't have been deported or who have been deported to places where they shouldn't have. So the instance of the individual from El Salvador who's now in a Salvadoran prison is a really important example. That individual had withholding of removal to El Salvador, which meant that the only place that he could not be removed to was El Salvador. And we find him now in El Salvador. And there's a lot of resistance about returning him back to the United States. These are instances where there's a clear example of a lack of due process. I think in general, what we can say about the process of deportation is that it is typically a really long process. So someone who has interaction with Immigration and Customs Enforcement will then typically be placed in a detention center to be held before there is the processing of removal, so the deportation processing. This typically takes weeks, months, a lot of time. And so the in-between, there's usually time to contact someone's loved ones and an attorney and try to get the matter resolved. But there are definitely indications where under the current administration, the process is happening faster and faster. And there are people who have not had due process. So Venezuelan individuals who were removed to El Salvador on the basis of being connected to the terror organization Tren de Aragua, which was framed as a terrorist organization. There was never a due process to really vet the claim about their connection to that organization. And so in those instances, I think we have a clear indication that there is worry for all of us to be concerned about this.
A lot of the campaign talk from the Trump campaign leading up to the election last year talked about violent people who perform violent crimes, who are charged with or convicted of violent crimes in the United States while in an illegal immigration status. Targets set of something on the order of 1,000 to 1,500 immigration arrests per day coming from the Trump administration. If we're looking for those kind of targets, can we do that just arresting people who have committed violent crimes, or does that have to, by just surely by those numbers, would that have to include other categories as well?
I believe it would have to include other numbers. And I think we're seeing indication of this. So as we look at the deportation regime right now, there are also other efforts that connect to this. So the administration is encouraging individuals in irregular status to self-deport. And they've created an application that you can have on your phone called CBP One or CBP Home, where that process can continue. I think we're seeing a lot of instances. That letter that the man from Nina received, I think, is another example of the regime of self-deportation that is a part of this. And so it is not the case that individuals with criminal convictions will be the only ones impacted by the deportation efforts. In fact, we've seen lots of indications that that's not the case. And then the other thing that I think is really important is that even individuals with criminal convictions, many of these people have charges that are for really relatively minor things, such as driving without a license. Oftentimes, when we think of who is a criminal, the vision is, you know, really severe. But in the context of immigration, that is just not the case. The majority of individuals who are in irregular status in the United States and maybe have had interaction with law enforcement are for really relatively minor infractions. And these individuals are also especially vulnerable to deportation. And of course, people with final orders of removal are vulnerable to deportation.
Sarah McKenna is with us from UW-Madison looking at deportation policy. Sarah, some people with various kinds of legal status seem to be targeted. We've seen here in Wisconsin, for example, students here under higher education visas, having that status removed. What are you watching for maybe on your own campus?
Yeah, there is a lot of concern and worry. Our international students, you know, we are in the midst of almost in final exam period, and the level of anxiety and fear has just skyrocketed. Our international students are worried at any moment that they'll receive a message that their CVIS status has been terminated or that their visa has been revoked. And there are many challenges to those cases in the courts. I think we're going to see a lot more information and clarity about whether or not that's possible, whether or not this was a process that follows the law. I think that's still left to be, that's still very much unclear. But in the midst of it, our students are really worried and concerned. It's challenging.
There are so many categories it may be difficult to answer this question. But if someone is either in person challenged by ICE, the knock on the door or whatever the case may be, or receives that email threatening deportation, what would the starting point be to see what their rights are?
Yeah, so I think it's important to understand the difference between public and private spaces or public and non-public spaces. So our homes are private spaces. So that means that for Immigration and Customs Enforcement to enter, there should be a judicial warrant that goes along with that, with specific information. In public spaces, we have seen instances of ICE officials picking up individuals that they're targeting for various dynamics. The young woman from Turkey, the student from Turkey who is now in a detention center, is a really, I think, excellent example of one of these instances. We have also seen under the administration a shift in protected spaces. So churches, schools, courthouses, hospitals, playgrounds, these are now places that the administration says ICE officials can do seizures in and around. There have been some challenges to that. So churches, there's an injunction on that case. At schools and hospitals, the dynamic between what's a public space in those spaces and what's a private space become really, really important to understand. And so there's just a lot of concern and worry about how one is navigating their life and where they can be at any given time.
I want to take our last just over a minute or so to ask about your research, your Migration in the Americas project, much bigger picture. What are you and your colleagues learning about migration to the United States?
Yeah, so the Migration in the Americas project built to really create more information about safe passageways of migration and safe places to reside throughout Latin America and the Americas, the Western Hemisphere. Our work has shifted in the last few months to think about the United States as a space and really to ramp up the information that's available for our immigrant communities here in the United States. But we also are continuing to work in Latin America. And one of the things that we've seen in the last few months is a shifting dynamic of reversed flow and forced return. So deportations to countries in Latin America then create a forced return. And also individuals are realizing, wow, there's no pathway for me to enter the United States to apply for asylum. So let me figure out my next best place to go for a safe place to live. I think that's really important to understand. For the majority of individuals we work with, they are really looking for a safe place to live for them and their families. And so that work continues in really nuanced ways with our partners throughout Latin America.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Sarah McKinnon, professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison. She's co-chair of the university's human rights program. She joined us for a look at the different groups affected by deportation in the last couple of months. If you have a story to share or a question about how all of this works for different people under different statuses, let us know about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, her mother was just 5 years old when she was separated from her parents and sent to St. Mary's Indian Boarding School in northern Wisconsin.
We may, I think, in many ways represent one of the, you know, most incredible survival stories, both culturally and physically, you know, in mankind.
Reckoning with the legacy of Indian boarding school, that's ahead. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As a citizen of the Bad River Ojibwe tribe in northern Wisconsin, Bernice Rabideau was just 5 years old when she and her siblings were separated from their parents. They were sent to St. Mary's Catholic Indian Boarding School in Odena, a small community on the Bad River Reservation. It was 1930. She wouldn't see her mother again for 2 years.
Bernice's daughter, journalist Mary Annette Pember, has researched the history of Indian boarding schools for decades and the toll that it took on her family.
Over nearly a century, at least 1,000 Native American children died in these schools, a trauma that's lasted for generations. As a warning, this conversation contains disturbing details of violence.
Pember's new book is called Medicine River, A Story of Survival and the Legacy of Indian Boarding Schools. She is a national correspondent for ICT News and a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Mary, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Well, hi, Kate. Great to be here.
Your mother, Bernice, was just 5 when she was sent to St. Mary's. And to think that her younger brother was only 3, was this normal for children to be taken from their parents and forced to go to these schools so young?
You know, in some cases, yes. Actually, by the time my mother went, you know, which is a little bit in the 30s, they had, generally speaking, actually realized that sending children so young was not necessarily a great idea. My mother and her siblings, however, were in a situation where both their parents were no longer available to raise them. And that contributed to their being sent to the sister school, to the boarding school.
Can you put into words what this separation was like for these children early on?
Well, you know, they really didn't know what was going on. I mean, they were just kids playing together. And one day someone came and took them away to this, you know, alien environment. And my mother would often tell me nobody ever explained anything to her, which was just really hard for a kid, you know. And I'm sure, you know, children typically, you know, blame themselves for things. And I'm sure she must have blamed herself. She must have thought, well, maybe I did something, I was naughty or so on. So I can imagine she really suffered terribly.
And the nuns were telling the children, like your mother, that they were dirty and lazy and that they needed to clean and clean some more. What effect did that psychological trauma have on your mom?
Well, that was the thing. I think that was the worst for her and for a lot of people, being sent that message that you are a priori, as it were, wrong and bad, just as you are, and that you've got to correct that. That is that's a powerful message to send to people, and that message has been sent to a lot of Native people for generations, until relatively recently.
You write about your relationship with Bernice, your mother, and infrequent hugs, your mother's sharp corners of her elbows, and then, you know, starting out under the kitchen table when you were little, when she became unstable. What was this relationship like between you two, and how you learned about what your mother went through?
When I was really little, you know, I think she was probably more affectionate with me than she was with others, certainly with my brothers. But I, you know, learned with her that she was a very mercurial person. She would get, as she described it, nervous. And I always wondered what that felt like. But I could see she would get really wound up, and she would sort of pace back and forth and smoke Camel Straight cigarettes and drink black coffee and kind of mutter to herself and angrily about trying to really, I think, write over those negative messages that the nuns gave her. So, you know, when you're a child, you become a pretty quick read of adults around you, and you learn to stay out of the way and not attract attention if things are not going well.
And you're right how she threw her stories down before you like a gauntlet, a challenge, and kind of daring you, begging you to validate her and what she was saying. What was that like for you?
Well, that whole sort of gauntlet aspect, that came later when I was a child, when I was really little. I mean, these were like my bedtime stories. And usually she put rather a positive spin on them. You know, she was kind of the little girl who survived and was strong and defiant and prevailed. But later in life, you know, she would, you know, really communicate to me her disgust with the hypocrisy and her real, even though in many ways, you know, she reinvented herself as a church lady, if you will. It always stuck in her craw, you know, she was very ambivalent about it.
And she learned how to talk to white people at boarding school, which I found really fascinating. Like, she learned how to read people and how to read these nuns. And she was then able to take that away and apply that to the white people who lived in her communities. Can you talk more about that?
And that may be among the most valuable lesson that Native people learned, children learned in boarding school, was how to navigate that world. What white people were threatened by, what made them, what made things easier for the children. You know, they were able to figure out that culture, you know, that they had entered into. And that was, in many ways, you know, they used that going forward if they, you know, were to live in the white world, which, you know, it was and it still is, you know, if you will, you know, white folks' world. And if you can't, walk that walk and talk that talk, I think often you find you're not as successful as you could be.
Sister Catherine, who ran St. Mary's boarding school for so long, how did Sister Catherine treat children like your mother?
Well, she was, you know, it was interesting. I talked to some people, you know, as adults who knew her and were in school when she was there. And some people thought that she may have had, you know, some sort of mental illness. And in actually in defense of many of those nuns, I mean, they would often stay, you know, in these places 24/7 within the missions with children. And that's not healthy, really, if one thinks of it. And, you know, if the nuns became very, very ill or something, they would maybe, you know, let them go to, you know, to the hospital or so on. But, you know, it was a big deal to transfer, to leave. So you had to make do. And, you know, one can imagine that might have been really stressful. Hmm. And, you know, I've heard a number of older folks, a number of elders talk about, you know, some of those nuns kind of went crazy.
And you find in the archives at Marquette University a photo and a letter from 1934 addressed to the head of the Bureau of Catholic Indian Missions. What was in the letter?
Well, it was basically a validation of a story my mother had told me my entire life. Hmm. She told me about a Christmas Eve when Sister Mary Catherine was going down to the cellar and she fell down the stairs. And she, you know, was injured. And then several days later, she died. And my mom would tell me, oh, what a secret cheer us kids did. You know, it was the best Christmas present we ever got. And I didn't really take it at face value. You know, I thought she had embellished it. And as an adult, I went to the archives and I was looking through like the lists and so on of our children's names and some of the records that were available. And to be honest, they weren't very revealing. For instance, they didn't really have anything about the children's performance or their grades even. Hmm. It was primarily the records were to, you know, they were ensured that they were paid, that the schools were paid. But the administrative correspondence turned out to be very rich. And I just totally stumbled on this letter that was written by the sister secretary to the Bureau of Catholic Indian Missions in Washington, D.C., basically, you know, essentially saying, you know, I regret to tell you that Sister Mary Catherine fell down the cellar steps and hit the bottom step with such force that she drove her glasses into her head and has been in a coma since, and we don't expect her to recover. And the language, it was, I know you'll pray for her in the suffering heart of Jesus. I don't know if those are the exact words, but I was seated in the archives by myself, reading at a big library table, and I read that, and I stood straight up out of my chair.
Mm. Because that was a true story coming from your mother.
Yes, that is absolutely what happened. And then, and people in Odena do tell that story to this day.
Hmm. Mary Annette Pember is with us, author of Medicine River, as we look at the history of Native American boarding schools and the impact on her own family. Mary, Bernice's little brother, Gerald, or he's called Rags, enters the boarding school at just 3 years old. What did Rags endure?
You know, I called up his son and his wife, and you know, they said that he didn't talk about it much, and he's gone now. Although they did say that he ran away when he was in eighth grade, but for a little guy, I mean, he was the youngest, and I think he was just, you know, sort of an extra mouth to feed. But he was this little dark guy, and, you know, the nuns were very impatient. And I mean, if you didn't obey, they would, you know, cuff you up, as they would say in those days. They would probably slap him. And he at one point, you know, the food was not very good a lot of times. And, of course, it was during the Depression, and it wasn't very good for a lot of people. But my mother recalled that the nuns fed them a dinner of stewed onions. And, of course, the three-year-old was not too interested in eating that, and so he wouldn't eat it. And the nuns were trying to, you know, they held him down, and they were trying to force-feed him these, you know, horrible, greasy, you know, onions. And so he was sputtering and coughing. And my uncle, my mother's elder brother, Don, he interceded, you know, and he pushed them away, and he's, you know, they backed him into a corner, my mother said, and he began swinging, and he hit one of the nuns, like in the solar plexus, and must have knocked the wind out of her and really shocked the nuns. And my mother called it, you know, Don, actually my aunt later verified that it was in the winter, and Don like ran in his pajamas all the way from the school to her house and, you know, showed up at the door and told my grandmother, would have been my great grandmother, what had happened. And she said, well, go to bed. And the next day she did go down to the school and, you know, and as my auntie said, she gave him hell, gave that nun hell, but you know, there really wasn't too much that, you know, could be done. Certainly my great grandma couldn't take them in. And the story was that so after all of this happened and after Don left, that they nailed Uncle Rags to the table all night. Now, and I thought, and I remember thinking about that later, and I thought, well, surely they couldn't have actually nailed his body, I mean, through his hands or something. They must have nailed his clothing, but they must have used a lot of nails, right? I mean, otherwise he could have gotten away. And I thought of how frightening that must have been for him. And then the other kids listening to him cry, he must have cried quite late and just fallen asleep.
Can you take a moment and talk about your grandmother, Seal, who puts these children in a essentially to live at the boarding school. And you say that she chose survival over motherhood. What was her life like?
Well, when she was married to my grandfather, who was quite a bit older, he's about 10 years older, Joe Rabideau, and he had been in the First World War in the infantry and had survived a number of gas attacks. And probably, you know, were we to know Joe now, we would say that he had, you know, PTSD and was untreated. And he drank quite a bit. And he just was not able to do well. He wasn't able to provide. There were really no jobs anyway. And he kind of gave up, and he drank quite a bit, and he would fight with Seal. And she was known to have a big mouth. Seal was the oldest, that her voice could be heard from a great distance, and she would chew you out. And he came home, he'd been drinking all day, and he drank up all the little bit of money they had, and she just started unleashing on him and yelling at him. And he appeared like really, really drunk, but somehow he collected himself and he attacked her just viciously. And actually, they were rolling on the ground, and he began biting into her, and he almost bit off one of her breasts. And my mother and Rags witnessed that. They were hiding under the kitchen table as this was all going on. And somehow Seal got to her feet, and she grabbed a beer bottle and she hit him over the head and knocked him out. And she was able to drag herself and the children over to her mother's house. And her mother was a midwife, and she doctored her. And afterwards, you know, she recovered. She didn't want to go back. But Seal had, you know, I mean, I can't imagine. Seal is just, it was like at that point, you know, it was personal survival.
Yeah.
You know, that was her choice. And she felt she had to save herself. And so she fled.
Since at least 2020, Congress has been considering the Indian Boarding School Policy Act, which would establish this investigative commission into our country's boarding school past. Where does this work stand now, and especially the idea of reparations?
Well, I have to say that I really don't think reparations will happen here. That's just my personal opinion. They happened in Canada, and that work began in 2007. The act did pass the Senate last administration, and the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is taking it up again. However, given the current climate, one wonders you know, even if it is passed, I don't know, would it get vetoed? You know, President Trump just recently, I think it was last week, he clawed back the National Endowment for the Humanities, several grants for instance, the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition and some other tribal groups to conduct interviews and collect stories and do various projects. It was like $1.5 million, but there were a lot of organizations that were going to benefit from that. And I think the wording was from the head of the agency that it no longer aligned with their, you know, with their current philosophies.
As we close, I want to ask you about healing and resilience, because you write about how that question misses the mark. And when we talk about the Native communities, what should people outside of Native communities be focused on instead of the question about resilience when it comes to this immense trauma?
Well, that we have, you know, we may, I think, in many ways represent one of the, you know, most incredible survival stories, both culturally and physically, you know, of in mankind. If one thinks of how we have been able to preserve our culture and languages to the degree that we have, I mean, it's remarkable. You know, we look now that, you know, our population around the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, our population was about 250,000 had diminished to. And, you know, what is it now? I mean, it's like something like 2 million. And, you know, depending upon who gathers that data, it could, you know, it could arguably be quite a bit more. So people have, you know, worked really hard and, you know, worked with the federal government and, you know, passed things like the Self-Determination Act, which actually turned 50 this year, in which Native people have to be consulted about federal programming and monies that are spent on their communities. So Native people have survived. We're incredibly scrappy people, and we have been able to make do with what we had and even flourish. So, you know, I don't know, some of these words, they just really kind of pale and I think fail to really give, you know, paint an adequate picture of how we have gone on and how we have ultimately thrived. But I think, you know, in many ways, we maintain our worldview in many ways. And I think we, you know, we can serve as an inspiration for a lot of people.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate.
Mary Annette Pember's new book is called Medicine River, A Story of Survival and the Legacy of Indian Boarding Schools. We talked about the schools and their collective trauma on families to this day.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a new essay collection looks at homesteading and the natural wonders of the Driftless region.
It's an area where a lot of alternative practices are going on, from, you know, the organic farming to alternative building and energy projects.
The book is Shelter and Storm. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For 15 years, writer Tamara Dean lived off the land in the heart of Wisconsin's Driftless region, known for its rolling hills and bluffs and deep river valleys carved from sandstone.
Tamara and her partner David spent that time homesteading and finding beauty and adventure in every corner of their 275-acre property.
In a new book of essays, Tamara Dean gives us a glimpse into all she's learned from her time in the Driftless area, including her quickly corrected misconceptions of what it's like to homestead with your partner. The book is called Shelter and Storm. Tamara, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
You write that the Driftless area is so improbable that some geologists refuse to accept it. Why is this area of land in southwestern Wisconsin so incredibly special?
It's one of the few areas in the world that was never touched by glaciers, but it's also the only area in the world that has no obvious explanation for that. All of North America's glaciers flowed around this area. But it's not higher than other places. It's not more porous around it. So even when other geologists had confirmed there's no evidence of drift, which is the debris like rocks and silt and sand that glaciers plow down as they move forward and then leave behind as they recede. Geologists out east, for example, was saying, well, this is just not possible. And even a geologist at the University of Wisconsin would not believe it. And he kept going out to this area, digging, looking for drift, but there just wasn't any.
Why do you think people are called to this region, especially new homesteaders?
I think, like I was, they're just seduced by this magical landscape. It's unlike any other place in the Midwest. It has these steep limestone bluffs and gorgeous, sparkling, spring-fed streams. It has narrow river valleys. That's what drew me initially. I didn't understand the history or the culture behind it. But soon that, too, presented itself as a reason to move there. It's a close-knit community. It's an area where a lot of alternative practices are going on from, you know, the organic farming that is really supported by Organic Valley, which is headquartered in that area, to alternative building and energy projects. It's an area, at least when we moved there, had no real zoning laws in our township. So, you know, if you wanted to build a house out of tires, you could. If you wanted to build a house out of wine bottles, you could do that.
Or if you want to build a house out of compressed earth blocks, go right ahead.
That's right.
Which you did. What was that like?
We did. We had tried out other methods of construction, including straw bale. That was how we made our wood shop. But it turned out that straw bales were not practical in this humid river valley. So we looked around for other options. What we wanted was something eco-friendly that we imagined could, you know, disappear into the earth long after we're gone. So we knew a guy who had a machine for making these compressed earth blocks. And basically, they're a combination of clay subsoil, which we dug when we put in our rainwater cistern and our septic system, and then sand, which we got for free for the hauling, really, from the dredging of the Mississippi. You know, the Army Corps of Engineers is always dredging that river for shipping lanes. And then a little bit of Portland cement to harden it and make it cure. And we made over 7,200 bricks or compressed earth blocks. They had to cure for a little while. And then we made a double masonry wall of these blocks. And in between, in the gap, we poured perlite insulation. So the walls were super insulated and thick. They kept the warmth in the winter, and they kept the house cool in the summer. So they worked in a very eco-friendly way.
How good were you at laying bricks?
Oh, you found that part in the book. I was terrible. I didn't understand how much skill it takes to work masonry. Mm. And I don't know if it's just my own lack of depth perception or what, but it was pretty bad. I did lay blocks in one area of the living room, but I could tell that that wall was a little skewed.
What did your neighbors think?
Well, you'd have to ask them, truly. I heard a little gossip while we were building, but as the structure went up, we had so many visitors and they were so curious. And one thing I learned about living in the country is, you know, people will just walk into your house and look around, especially if it's not finished. But we had visitors come along for years and ask for tours, and they were all so amazed by what we'd done. You know, the house had the mud brick walls, but it also had a central fireplace, a central stove made out of rocks that we had gathered from the hills on our property. And, you know, it had wood cabinets made from the trees on our property. So it was really beautiful.
We're talking about Shelter and Storm. It's a new book of essays by Wisconsin author Tamara Dean. It's reflecting on life in the Driftless region of Wisconsin. The first essay in your book, it's called So Near the Soil, and it addresses what it's like to try farming. And it's something that you had never done before. And you started off really confident and really hopeful. What were some of the challenges that surprised you most as an entry-level farmer?
Right. I had the impression that because I came from a long line of farmers, you know, all the way back in municipal records and family stories, that somehow I would be born with this understanding of how to grow crops. Of course, that was naive. And I started with a large garden, but gardens and crops are entirely different. When I looked out at my neighbor's fields, I was trying to also do the math. You know, could I grow 40 acres of organic, diverse vegetables and fruits? I didn't want to grow the commodity crops like corn and soybeans. But I also found out from asking around and studying what neighbors were doing that commodity crops are supported by the USDA through subsidies and grants and crop insurance. And at that time, there was no safety net for growers of organic mixed crops like vegetables and fruits. And I saw some of our neighbors get entirely wiped out year after year because of these record-breaking floods that the Driftless area was experiencing. And I thought, I don't have the risk tolerance for this kind of lifestyle, and I don't understand how a person can make the bottom line positive growing the kinds of things that I wanted to grow.
Yes, because you had tried to, or you had planned to trade writing for farming and make a living as a farmer, but then you put that together and you meet with the USDA and try to chart out a plan for what to do with this land, and it just doesn't pencil out.
Yeah, and another thing about USDA subsidies is that they're given to large agribusinesses. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the kind of land that allowed for that kind of business. So those USDA programs weren't as helpful to me as they would be to, you know, a giant CAFO or conglomerate farm.
And you call yourself a steward of the land, not like a property owner. And I wonder if that distinction made it more difficult to decide what to do with these acres.
I think you're pointing to the fact that I can overthink anything. Yeah, that's true. I thought of myself as a steward in part because I understand that everything about land, our idea of its use and where the boundaries are and who gets to use it and who gets to speak for it and whose history is, you know, authorized, is political. I didn't feel entitled to take ownership of land in that same way. I wanted to be able to question and to learn and adapt. So ultimately, I was intrigued by the pollinator habitat grants that President Obama instituted, I think it was in 2014, when everyone recognized that bees and butterflies and other pollinators were in trouble, and they're necessary for growing larger crops, any crops. And so I did take advantage of one of those USDA grants to plant an old hay field into a new prairie.
In terms of the prairie, in your essay, Fire and Time, you talk about conducting controlled burns on your property to start to restore a prairie to prepare for the reintroduction of native grasses and flowers. And you take us through these burns, and one when it's losing control and then you get it back under control, and you're just baffled by how this works. Can you tell us about the experience of a controlled burn?
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, you mow and dig these lanes or alleys so that they're fire breaks. We burned this old hay field in four sections, and I thought that would be more controlled. I don't know if that was really true, but a few of the burns went flawlessly. And then one, when we decided we could do it ourselves without our neighbor's help, without the help of experts, did almost get out of control. We had thought our final burn was just flawless, too. Like the first burn, we had our friends helping at that time, and everybody agreed this was a perfect burn. And then about an hour later, when my partner went up to the hilltop to just retrieve the tractor and check on everything, he found that The whole ridgetop was on fire at the edges and moving toward the neighbor's property. And he called me with his cell phone back at home about a mile away. I was already starting to nap. And he said, "I'm not panicking, but the fire has gone to the woods in this direction. It's gone to our neighbor's field in that direction, and we need help." And to the credit of our neighbors, you know, I called them and I said, "Can we get that equipment we borrowed back from you?" And they said, "We're coming to help. We had plans this evening, but this is our plan now." And they did. And we extinguished the fire without much more drama, except that that night, an old ash tree that was hollow in the middle was on fire and spraying sparks about 100 feet in the air. Not really harmful because all the ground around it had already been charred, but it was dramatic.
But there's a difference between good fires and bad fires. And you write about when fire is withheld or suppressed, that prairies stagnate. Can you talk a little bit more? Because in our heads, we think that, you know, fires can be really harmful, and yet we need them.
Right. The prairies do need fires to keep down the woody brush that would otherwise dominate and prevent the other native flora and other species from thriving. So fire is both necessary, but it's fraught sometimes.
You now live in Madison, and hearing about all the work you put into this land in the Driftless area, all of these memories and stories, why did you decide to leave?
It was a heartbreaking decision, but some people know of the Driftless area as the Midwest's epicenter for Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. And unfortunately, you know, spending so much time in prairies and meadows and gardens and woods out in the Driftless area, I did often get bitten by ticks, and I had several cases of Lyme disease. The last one, which I noticed starting around 2016, ended up lasting almost 5 years. I think it might be like the long COVID cases that people are talking about, where you just don't have energy or you don't know from day to day whether you'll be able to get out of bed and function. And it was impossible for me to maintain the energy for our lifestyle, which included, you know, chopping wood and mowing and pruning trees and planting and harvesting and
very
putting up
physical.
Produce. Yes.
Yeah. Since leaving the Driftless, I wonder, you know, all of these essays have the common thread of this region, of this glorious region. And I'm wondering, as a writer, was it hard to write about something else?
Life in the Driftless area seemed to present constant drama. You know, all I had to do was step outside, it seemed, and I would be presented with something astonishing, good or bad, or just curious and weird. So the material kept coming. And initially, when I moved to the Driftless area, I was a fiction writer and a technical writer, but not really an essayist. And then I thought, well, the drama here, you know, overshadows any kind of fictional storyline. But it turns out that I have had more material come toward me. About 6 months after we left the Driftless area, I was walking across the street in Minneapolis and I was run over by an SUV. And I wrote about that experience and the recovery and pedestrian rights. And then, you know, more things keep happening. And I'm still astonished by nature. One thing I took with me from the Driftless area was that if you're open-hearted and open-minded as you're walking through the outdoors or interacting with neighbors and your community, you're bound to be rewarded with, you know, insights and wonder.
Tamara, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Tamara Dean's new essay collection is called Shelter in Storm. The book is about the 15 years she and her partner spent living off the land in the Driftless area. And Tamara is on a book tour around Wisconsin with events on April 26th in Viroqua, May 1st in La Crosse, and May 9th in Egg Harbor, among the stops. We'll be right back. Fat Bear Week happens every fall where people vote on the brown bears at a national park in Alaska. And some people are big fans of those bears, people like Rob Ferret.
It's true. And this just came into our email, a similar competition here in Wisconsin. But not for bears. It's going to be Fat Bird Week.
Okay, it's coming up in early May from the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin and the group Save Our Songbirds. People can vote in a bracket-style competition.
That bracket is up now with special names for the birds, including the enormous eastern bluebird, the pudgy pine warbler, and the necklace northern cardinal.
Do you have a favorite bird to see this time of year? Are there songbirds showing up in your neighborhood or even your back? Yard now. Email us, wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Courtney Everett, Royce Podeswa, and Avery Lee Rogers. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.